now. Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, tonight's guest is on a campaign to change the world. And while it's personal in a sense to him, it is very personal to you, the listener, because while the bigger picture is of course global, the roots of this grow from the dinner plate right in front of you. He's a medical doctor by trade. He's got a master's PhD in public health and a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard University. He's as qualified as they come on the books, but on our TV screens as well, as one of the stars of ABC's Ask the Doctors and the CEO, of course, of Vic Health. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, Dr. Sandro Di Meo. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
You're a busy man. You have so much on your plate, pardon the pun.
It's true. It's true. I'm a few weeks into a new job. Lots happening, but it's really exciting times and it's what gets me excited. It's what gives me energy. So
you have some incredible things on the go.
Thank you.
We can interview people on this show that we call Great Australians who are far further in their career than you and far further in their life than you. You've achieved a lot, you know, in your time already. You're proud of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm conscious that I've been very lucky. Growing up in Australia, growing up in Melbourne, I was given a lot of opportunities and we're all given a deck of cards in life, and I was given probably a better deck than most in Australia and certainly a better deck than most in the world. You know, I love doing good things with the opportunities that I've been given, and look, I am proud, and I'm proud of those that work with me and the huge number of people that make my work possible, mentors, friends, peers, and of course, team members.
Speaking of opportunities, you are the CEO of Vic Health, as we mentioned, and you just come from a meeting with the government. What can we expect from Vic Health, from the new CEO?
Look, Vic Health has its roots. Actually, it's one of the original health promotion foundations in the world. It was established in 1987 through a hypothecated tax, which is a sort of a fancy word for basically saying that we taxed tobacco and we used that money to buy out advertising of the tobacco industry
in
sport and arts and Formula One and all those sorts of things. Really great idea. And actually it was such a great idea that it was copied all around the world. So we became sort of the poster child for health promotion foundations.
I read that and I thought that was great. Even countries like Portugal who are more progressive than us in other health areas, especially in terms of drug law reform, copied us.
They did.
I found that quite flattering.
and there's an organisation, an incredible organisation called Thai Health, which is modelled not only in what it does, but also its name after Vic Health. And it's always been an organisation that's been a leader, that's been a pioneer and an innovator. Mm. It's always led the world in research, but also in, you know, running things like the QUIT program with the Cancer Council. We funded right from the beginning the SunSmart initiatives, and we've funded a huge amount of research and other things through the funding that we do receive from Victorian taxpayers, from mums and dads across Victoria. I'm excited to be in the role. We really want to continue to innovate. We'll continue our work across the core areas that we focus around preventing tobacco use, improving the health and nutrition of Victorians, getting more Victorians active and making it easier for them to get regular exercise, reducing the harmful use of alcohol, and of course, improving the mental health of Victorians. But a big focus for us in the 12 months ahead will also be supporting and working closely with the Victorian government. We have a very visionary and ambitious State Minister for Health, Jenny Makarkos, who is very eager to do some very important work, particularly for young Victorians, and we're very excited to work with her on that. Also, we do have an amazing group of people. So it's about 75 of us based in Carlton, and I'm really excited to be leading Vic Health.
Congratulations. You mentioned the tobacco industry, and I think for most people in the population, we would feel like that's a battle that's been won. We don't see advertising anywhere anymore. I think, and I don't know this, I would presume that younger people are not smoking as much as they were. You could correct me if I'm wrong. But I have heard you say in one of your lectures that there is a lot going on behind the scenes and we are still in courtrooms around the world battling the tobacco industry. So that fight is it won?
The fight is long from over. In fact, the fight will really never end. We're talking a multi-billion dollar industry that will continue to fight to try and get tobacco in the hands of young people, in the hands of
How
vulnerable groups.
It?
Well, they're doing it increasingly in low and middle income countries. So they've moved a lot of their target to countries that don't have the same, you know, level of policy or leadership from government maybe that we have been able to have in Australia. I mean, don't forget that we had to fight very hard to defend the laws that we brought in around tobacco packaging, around pricing. Every step of the way the tobacco industry fought back, took, in fact, our government to court, costing the Australian taxpayer a lot of money to protect ourselves and our children from something we know kills one in two of its users. There is no other product that is specifically designed in a way that will kill one in two of its users. And yet we had to spend millions of dollars defending laws that we are fully entitled to implement to protect the public. And we continue to defend those in international courts. We're constantly being attacked and undermined in international courts. They will find any way that they can to try and repeal the progress we've made and stop further progress being made. And so that will be a fight that continues on.
How do they justify what they're doing? If they're in a courtroom and you're arguing for the health of whatever nation they're infiltrating or ramping up their advertising, what justification and argument do they use?
Well, look, often the argument that they give you is not the real argument. The real argument is purely economics. They want to make money and profit off the suffering of people and through the addiction of people to products, as I say, are designed to kill one in two of their users. And it's very similar in some other industries. The same tactics are used for the same reasons, basically profit over public health and particularly the health of children. What they'll say is that it's an infringement of their intellectual property law. So they'll say, you know, that by forcing brands to have the kind of olive green packaging, the packaging that we've really led the world on, and huge kudos to Australian policymakers for making that possible and defending it. They say that that's stealing their intellectual property, that they developed that brand over many decades. At the end of the day, there is a right, there is a rule within international trade law. Also, we have human rights agreements. We have multiple agreements at the global level and at the country level that mandates governments but also protects governments to take measures that put the lives of citizens ahead of the profits of private companies. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't continue to fight on that progress. Those provisions are there. It's just that they, you know, as with all laws, unfortunately, they're debatable, and so they continue to be debated.
Let's talk about you before we get any further into the incredible work that you're doing. You're a Melbourne boy.
I am.
A young Melbourne boy from Italian descent.
I am.
Very obvious from the surname.
Yeah.
What was life like for you? You had two brothers.
Yeah, I grew up in a big Italian family in Melbourne's eastern suburbs.
What does your family, what does Nonna feel about you telling people what to eat? Because as far as I know, no one argues with Nonna when it comes to dinner time.
Well, I mean, if she was alive, she'd be about 107 now. She died at 101. So
she had a pretty good
diet.
There's
some telling on the quality of her diet.
Yeah.
I think she'd be shaking her head saying, I've been doing this all my life. Why
carbs
do you need to...
all the way.
I mean, a lot of what they ate was, you know, what we kind of call the modified Mediterranean diet, which is actually what we have the best evidence for. It's, you know, it's lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, less meat than probably most Australians eat, certainly my nonna. It was something that was a privilege, not a right necessarily every day. Healthy oils, lots of olive oil. She'd probably sort of scratch her head and wonder why this is such a big deal, because it's just how she ate. And it's the same for many migrant groups. If you go back one or two generations, while they had problems affording good food and a balanced, nutritious diet, what they could afford, if they could afford it, was actually a very nutritious way of eating. It's just that we've undone that over the last four or five decades.
I always think about this when you look at pictures, especially in Europe and Britain from hundreds of years ago. The indication of wealth was that you were fat or plump. That meant you could afford food. Whereas now it's the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly there is a strong connection. There is a strong link between more vulnerable populations, lower income families, and increased risk of overweight, obesity. And also not only the risk of overweight and obesity, but the risk of the diseases associated with them. And then, of course, the worse outcomes with if you do develop those diseases. And that's because of issues around access to healthcare. But it comes back to the affordability and access to a healthy diet. So yeah, that has flipped. But you know, going back 100 years, overweight and obesity rates were a fraction of what they were today. The major challenge facing the planet was in fact hunger. You jump forward today and we've got 2.5 times as many people across the entire planet that are overweight or obese than go hungry.
Many of us, whether we're overweight or obese, are malnourished, aren't we?
That's correct. Then there's another layer of which is malnutrition. And in fact, we know that, for example, while 2 in 3 Australians now really struggle to maintain a healthy weight and to afford those healthy options that would provide them with a healthy weight, 2 in 3 of those are actually still malnourished because our diets have become so rich in foods that are unhealthy. We're not actually getting the vitamins and minerals that we need, but we're getting a lot of calories, a lot of foods that are causing us to put on weight.
Now back to the young DiMeo family. Where in Melbourne?
Yeah, so we grew up just near Caulfield.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, near Monash Uni and Caulfield Station.
Was food and the interest
I was always at the centre.
So you always, even as a little boy,
absolutely,
were interested in what's in my food, how is it good for me?
Definitely, yeah. Wow. My grandma and my nonna, because my grandma on one side is Welsh and then my nonna on the other is Italian, they were both really great cooks. Food was always at the centre of love and family. My mum and dad are both great cooks, so we always cook together. Dad probably does a little bit more of the cooking than mum, but from the earliest age, I was up on the bench helping mum, you know, probably not helping mum. I was getting involved
thinking
and putting things
mum
everywhere and putting salt in sweet things and experimenting. But food was always at the centre. You know, in the summer we would, you know, get a few big boxes of tomatoes fresh from our cousins in Cobram and make the passata. Again, this was before it became hipster. In these days it was pretty uncouth, but it was our way of celebrating summer and bottling the summer tomatoes for the year ahead. And then in the winter, very often we'd actually get a whole pig. And a few families would get together a very cold morning, you know, 0-1 degree, 3 o'clock in the morning, the pig would arrive and then we'd butcher it and make the salamis and the prosciuttos. And those things would last us, you know, cure and salt the meats. And those things would last us, you know, that pig would last an entire year.
Yeah.
I think it was those experiences that really made that connection with real food, with, you know, what we've come to now call slow food. But it was really just taking time as a family. And it was also because my parents were not affluent when I was young. My grandparents arrived on the Italian side as illiterate, very poor migrants from Italy. Mm. They didn't speak English. Food was a way you could provide love to your family that was affordable.
They've also given you now, pardon the cliche or the pun, you now have a wealth of knowledge from them. And that's a wealth of knowledge that most people don't have. I know that as a kid, there was no pig turning up at 3 o'clock in the morning and we weren't making, you know,
most
salami.
Most people might be thankful for that.
But, you know, that's something that you have now that most people don't. And that's so useful.
Yeah, it is. Look, and I love it. I mean, a few weeks ago here in Melbourne, it was artichoke season. And so Dad and I got a huge box of artichokes, the little tiny artichokes, which are just delicious, from, again, my cousin's farm. And we pickle them, we cut them all down, pickle them, jar them, and we have now artichoke hearts for the year ahead because I can eat my weight in artichoke hearts. And it's not a very affordable pastime if you're buying them from overseas. But, you know, again, it was a couple of hours together just playing around, experimenting, and then you walk away with some delicious food that suddenly all of my brothers and my cousins and my friends turn up saying, could we take a few of those home as well?
That artichoke.
Yeah, luckily there's enough for everyone.
Now, Dad was a doctor too, was he not? So you followed in his footsteps in a way.
Yeah, that's right. So Dad was a GP and really more than a GP. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. It was in his blood. As I said, my grandparents arrived from Italy in the 30s and 40s with nothing and were interned during the war. They worked in the Murray River scheme, very tough conditions, and then built a business from scratch. So it was ingrained in my dad, sort of that entrepreneurialism and that business that's often goes with the, you know, those first couple of generations of migrants, regardless of what their background or ethnicity is. So he actually built up a fairly large medical practice in Burwood, in Melbourne's
east.
Yeah, and Mum also is just an amazing human being. I mean, she's the rock of the family. She holds everyone together. She grounds my dad. She was not only a healthcare professional herself; she was an occupational therapist and an amazing one. She volunteered in the community all throughout my life. She also was the first receptionist. She was the cleaner. She was the bookkeeper at Dad's clinic, and really helped Dad to get that business off the ground. So I got the kind of interest in medicine and community from my mum and my dad. Mm. My grandma was in fact a nurse during the war, so it probably goes back even one more generation. But I also got the need for innovation and the entrepreneurial spirit, kind of taking on big challenges and building things. I got that from Dad, definitely.
Well, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. In a moment, we'll follow Dr. Sandro De Meo to Cambodia, Denmark and even Mongolia as he pursues his passion for public health. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight, we are celebrating the life and inspiring work of Dr. Sandro De Meo, a doctor of medicine, a TV doctor, and of course, the CEO of Vic Health, among many, many things. Now, in your early years of medical practice, you were working as a doctor at the Alfred, which all Melburnians and probably all Australians would know. But you're also studying a master's in public health, which took you to Cambodia. Mm. What a different experience. Had you been to a country like that when you set foot in Cambodia?
I'd travelled to Cambodia in medical school. Mm-hmm. And so during medical school, there were a couple of experiences that made me realise that my life path was going to be outside of clinical medicine. My dad, you know, being a GP, I knew the importance of a really great clinician, the importance, the difference that could make to a family, to an individual. But it was experiences like working in Mount Isa and Mornington Island in Indigenous communities as a medical student, seeing the level of deprivation and poverty, but also the incredible human spirit and perseverance and courage of regional and remote communities and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. It was an experience in Sri Lanka after the Boxing Day tsunami doing aid work and realizing that the diseases that we were struggling with here in Australia, you know, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, preventable diseases that we know how to prevent if we just take action in a way that the evidence suggests, you know, Sri Lankans were dying of the same diseases. And that wasn't what I expected. I expected to go to aid camps in remote Sri Lanka, you know, in 2004 and see infectious disease, starvation. Yes. That wasn't the case. It was mental illness. It was cardiovascular disease. It was, you know, individuals being chained to trees because they couldn't get their antipsychotic medication. It was people coming in with vision disturbance and headaches because they couldn't get their heart medication. The final sort of straw for me was then during the first year of medicine working at the Alfred, and it was an amazing workplace where they were very flexible and encouraging of clinicians to, you know, choose their own path. So I started a master's in public health and found myself in Cambodia running or helping to run a program where we actually worked with local Buddhist monks as a way of then providing health education to communities all across Cambodia. So rather than, you know, a white Australian coming to Cambodia, telling local Cambodians to change what they're eating, eat less salt, get more exercise, it's totally inappropriate.
Yes.
Instead, we worked with the Buddhist monk platform there through actually a friend of mine who was a clinician in the biggest Buddhist temple, Wat Lanka, at the time. We provided health education to the monks themselves. They actually had very high rates of hypertension and diabetes, high blood pressure and diabetes because of their diet is largely white rice, refined white rice. So we were able to help them improve their health. And then what we found was that they were integrating that health information into their teaching in the local community. And that was a far more effective way of encouraging people to eat healthier food, more fruits and vegetables, locally and culturally appropriate fruits and vegetables, to maybe get more exercise, to not maybe take the same path that Australians had taken to, you know, some of these worse health outcomes. It was a far more effective way of delivering that. And we managed to publish that. And I think that really took me off on the path of, okay, there are ways that we can work in some of the poorest communities on the planet to ensure that they can not only become healthier, but also as they develop, become, you know, more prosperous, and coming back to that, the bigger vision of leaving no one behind, as is our global goal under the United Nations, that I could be part of that and I could actually use my skills to try and influence positively the health of populations rather than working at the coalface with one-on-one with patients.
Fast forward to coming back to Australia for a minute, do you find that communities such as ours don't listen to that message, that you've helped, you know, communities in Cambodia and other countries and they appear to have taken on board your knowledge? Do you get frustrated here in Australia, or are we taking on enough of the message?
I definitely don't get frustrated at everyday people, because I know how hard it is to actually adopt what we're trying to get people to do. So, you know, I think most mums and dads know that they want to be eating as healthy as possible. They want to get access to healthier food options. They want to try and get some exercise into their day. But it's tough. You need to be able to afford it. You need to have the time for it. And most of us are working, you know, at least one job, commuting long distances. What food is available on our commute to and from work on the side of the freeway? Certainly not fresh food options. It's mostly fast food. It's convenience food.
That, and you might know the answer to this, sorry to interrupt, but this is something that I think about probably every second day. Why is there so easily go through the drive-thru at McDonald's and get a hamburger that's highly processed and full of salt and all the rest, and there is no drive-thru sandwiches? Is it that it's not marketable, or people don't want it, or why can't I go through a drive-thru and get something healthy?
Probably the short answer is that those foods that are really high in salt, fat and sugar, the so-called junk foods, the unhealthier options, are hugely profitable. And so someone is making a huge amount of profit from selling more and more of the wrong foods and pushing the unhealthier options on our kids, through their phones, on us all, through billboards. We're reminded of it on every corner. There's advertising everywhere for these foods. So when we get reminded 20 times a day, and then you combine that with the fact that it's artificially cheap, all of the health outcomes that we know are associated, weight gain, diabetes, heart disease, that we know are associated with eating too much of these unhealthy options, those health outcomes are not built into the price of the product. We, you know, we ignore them when we buy our burger. So the burger is high in salt, fat and sugar, hugely profitable for these big corporations to make and sell. They can advertise everywhere to increase and to remind us and to make us think we actually want more than we do. And then when we do eat it, those things are so high in salt, fat and sugar that they've been built from scratch to make our brain do all sorts of things. Yeah, that it makes us feel a certain way, or it make, between the advertising and the way the food's been constructed, the way these unhealthy products are being constructed, it does all sorts of things to our brain that reinforces that. So
I heard you saying in a lecture that our happiness was brought to us by Coca-Cola, and our
summer was
Coca-Cola, happiness was Cadbury, and
your name is even written on the bottle.
Yeah. So you know, there is this very clever marketing there.
It's very clever.
Brings me to the point of what do we do about this? So there's Coca-Cola everywhere we go, billboards, on the freeway. There's Cadbury is part of our life, you know. It's everywhere. What do we do?
It's not easy, first of all, and it's not the fault of the individual. If you had a class of 30 children and one of them was getting poorer grades than the rest, you might look at the individual and think, you know, something's going on at home. They have an issue that rests with that one child. But if you had two-thirds of the class getting poorer results than every other class, or suddenly two-thirds of the class just started getting poorer results, I mean, first of all, we'd be really worried. Secondly, we'd be assuming that it's a problem with the teacher, with the classroom, with the environment. It's a structural problem. It's not suddenly that two-thirds of the students have become less intelligent or are making poor choices. And yet 2 in 3 Australians are overweight or obese, and we continue to shame and blame the individual. The first thing is to realise that this is actually a problem with the environment. It's a problem born and solved in changes at the population level. It's about reducing the amount of advertising for unhealthy food. So we're not reminded on every corner and on our phones and on our TV screens every day of these unhealthy foods, and those unhealthy foods aren't reinforced in our minds, that we're not allowing at least our children to be specifically targeted with campaigns that really prey on, you know, their favourite cartoon characters, colours, flavours.
Oh, handing out toys with a meal is...
Yeah, or vouchers, you know, yeah, for a meal when you do something,
yep,
you know, do something
sport,
well.
Or
allowing our supermarket environments to be built so that the foods that we know are targeting our kids are at the height of our kids in the supermarket. I mean, these sorts of things are not okay. So we first of all need to protect our kids from the marketing of unhealthy products. Secondly, we need to think also about how can we empower the consumer to understand what are the better options. So looking at labelling, for example, we've done some great work in tobacco to make it really clear that tobacco kills one in two of its users. What are we doing to make it clearer for the consumer so that a busy mum who has 20 seconds in the supermarket and is trying to choose between two products, how can we make it as easy as possible for her or him to say, yep, that's the one that's best for my kids?
Well, that's interesting because as we were talking off air, I am a newish mum, but I find it really hard. Sometimes I have to rely on packaged food. I'd like to give my children as much of homemade food as I can, but sometimes I have to give them packaged food. So I go with the organic. It says organic, it's certified organic, and I read everything. It might have water, apple, banana in it. And you think, okay, so there's no added salt, no added colour, no added sugar, but there's still things in there that I don't know about, obviously, because my children, for some reason, prefer that product than what I've cooked them.
Yeah, so
my cooking's not that bad.
Well, talking off air, your cooking sounds great. But I'm waiting for a dinner invitation. But no, I mean, I think that's true. And so part of it is the advertising. So the colours on the packet, the way the packet, you know, has...
But they're less than 1 year old. Are they engaging with...
Absolutely. The evidence suggests that at 6 months, kids are starting to link brands with preference.
So they're blindfolded from now on in the high chair, okay?
So you know, and industry knows this. So industry knows that at 6 months, kids will start to build links between, and
that is
not
amazing.
Even build links, but start to build preferences for the rest of their lives for certain products. So yes, the companies are targeting children as young as 6 months old to get them to preference their products, unhealthy products that are often high in salt, fat and sugar, from as early as possible. Then when they grow up and they reach, you go to the supermarket, what do they reach for? They reach for the things that have been advertised through the YouTube channel that they were just watching at home, or through product placement, or because they have certain colours that they know will, you know, get the kids, young kids excited. Mm. Then as soon as they eat the product, well, yes, it might be organic, and yes, it might be, no added this, that, and the other. But, you know, things like fruit concentrates, which are basically, yes, you can say it's 100% fruit, but at the end of the day, it will still be 60% sugar.
Mm.
It's just that it's
fructose
sugar that came
sugar
from an apple and was concentrated, which we know, you know, and the World Health Organization and a number of government bodies have said that it's no better than added sugar, really no better than added sugar. But this is, again, where parents are being taken for a ride by industry that are not telling them the full story. They're making it as hard as possible for parents to do the right thing
it's
for
sad,
their kids
isn't it?
And to make the healthy option for them and their kids. And these are the things that we really need to start changing if we're serious about tackling the health issues facing Australians.
I'm Laura Turner and you're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. More with Dr. Sandro De Meo in just a moment. Great to have your company on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner, and tonight we are celebrating the life and work of Dr. Sandro De Meo, who has published more than 30 scientific papers, 90 articles, and even written his own cookbook, Doctor's Diet. First of all, Doctor, is there anything you can't do? You seem like
lots
the busiest man on earth.
Lots of things.
The last segment we're talking about you going to Cambodia, but of course I know you then went on to Denmark, Copenhagen.
Yep.
There is so much of your life that's happened before you even came back to Australia.
Yeah.
But you've gathered this wealth of knowledge. It's
10 years I've been abroad, and in that time, spent 3 years in Copenhagen, which was an amazing experience seeing what is possible. So Denmark has an obesity rate a third of Australia, but a GDP or an income level roughly the same.
What's the difference? What did you learn?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Right.
And the city of Copenhagen is about half or a third the size of Melbourne. It's probably more similar to Geelong.
Is it urban planning that helps?
Partly, yeah. So partly it's a healthcare system that supports prevention more holistically. Partly it's, for example, they have a year of maternity or paternity leave. So women and men...
Paid.
So women and men can actually stay home, and if they want to breastfeed, and breastfeeding is an extremely important practice that, you know, we should be supporting mums and dads to do more of if they can. But it's again, it's tough for parents. They're returning to work. Sometimes the workplace is not particularly supportive.
Well, running
maybe it's
off
not
and
even
expressing
possible.
Milk can be awkward.
No,
can be uncomfortable.
Let alone
can be
then
not supported.
Exactly. Let alone then the effects that it can have on people and their careers. So, you know, Denmark has actually said no, that you get a year off between you. You can split it however you want. The mother needs to take 3 months, but the rest is split however they want. And that allows them to actually invest that early time in the next generation. Another thing is, yeah, absolutely urban design. They have
getting more exercise.
They have bike lanes, separated bike lanes everywhere. I mean, another really important, really interesting social policy is around supermarkets. So they've actually put a policy in place or a government directive in place that they're not going to have big supermarkets that you have to drive to, and maybe then you don't even have them in some suburbs like here in Australia. They actually have lots of smaller supermarkets. And so on your bike ride to or from work or on your drive to and from work, instead of passing 35 fast food outlets, you pass 35 small supermarkets. It increases competition, it drives down prices, but also it makes it far more accessible for people to, you know, do their fresh shop on the way to or from work. It's things like this that I saw in practice and realized, gosh, we can actually live differently. And it's not about giving up all of the things that we love. It's not about deserting a thriving economy. I mean, they have a thriving economy and very low rates of unemployment. And yet they still are able to achieve better health outcomes and much lower rates of obesity. So Denmark was really formative for that, but it was also interesting because I was spending half my time in Denmark and half my time in Mongolia, which was where I was actually doing my PhD research. And Mongolia was the fastest growing economy at the time. It was 20% GDP growth, so 20% growth in their economy every year. The country was literally transforming in front of my eyes. And I was given the opportunity to go across there and originally just do a once-off lecture. But as you can see, I have no problems talking. And so after the lecture, I had all these questions from government people in the room. And they were saying, you know, how could we work on this? How can we work on that? I kept talking and kept talking, giving advice, giving ideas. And they said, oh, Sandra, could you, we've actually got an opening for an expert to come and deliver health, public health lectures in remote parts of Mongolia. So it's the second largest landlocked country in the world. This is a big country.
Yeah.
Could you come and deliver lectures in remote parts of Mongolia to our regional and local public health staff? Come 4 or 5 times. I said, absolutely, I'd love to.
What was the language barrier like for you?
I had simultaneous translation.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating language, very similar to Russian, sounds very similar to Russian. So I found myself then over the next couple of months in a yurt with a projector with a small, with about 20 or 30 Mongolian local public health staff and a translator, no one else from a non-Mongolian background.
How exciting, though.
I would drive
great
like,
memories.
Oh, yeah. I would drive like 12 hours into the countryside and suddenly, so one day I was, I remember very clearly, I was delivering health promotion 101 kind of lectures in the demilitarized zone between Russia and Mongolia in a yurt with a projector running off a diesel generator. And then that evening, let me just say this, that Dirty Dancing to Boney M, Rivers of Babylon with 30 Mongolian public health staff deep in the demilitarized zone between Russia and Mongolia, and then stumbling across a Russian guard with a very impressive and scary looking rifle on my way back to my small Mongolian bed in my own yurt that night, was an extremely extremely interesting experience.
I can imagine.
But seeing the country transform, seeing the country go from giving up their horses and moving to four-wheel drives, giving up yurts and going to apartment living. I saw the first KFC open. I saw the 400-meter-long line down the street in Ulaanbaatar to taste, you know, the fried chicken and all of the unhealthy foods that were starting, unhealthy products that were starting to, you know, flood into Mongolia as it opened up after leaving the Soviet Union. I saw all of that transform, and I also saw rates of overweight, obesity, diabetes, cancer, skyrocket in the country while I was there. And so seeing what was possible, seeing how similar the challenges were to what we were facing in Australia, seeing the difference that I could make with these incredibly committed and passionate public health staff there in Mongolia was amazing. It was eye-opening. And just
great too, because you come from an example where it's so much further down the road. You know, you can see the future when you're in Mongolia in terms of
and seeing the pitfalls that we want to try and avoid. And it was, yeah, it was an amazing experience. And I think for me also, because I was able to see what was working in Denmark, what was working and not working in Australia, and what could work, and the level of vision and courage and foresight and intelligence that the Mongolian team had, that I could learn from them, and also they could learn in part from what I was bringing. And so that was an incredible 3 years. Flying through Beijing to Mongolia in itself was an experience. It really, again, just reinforced that I was on the right path and really loved what I was doing.
Absolutely. Well, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. More with Dr. Sandro De Meo when we return. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tonight, we are celebrating the incredible life and work of Dr. Sandro De Meo, who I mentioned earlier in last segment, has written a book of which all the proceeds go to charity. How's the book going?
It's going very well. Yeah, it's called The Doctor's Diet. And the idea was really that when I was a clinician and speaking to clinician doctors, they wanted something evidence-based but really easy to read that people could take. It's 110 original recipes from my own kitchen based on the modified Mediterranean diet. So what we know is best for your health. It integrates things like how to read a nutrition label, what's in season. It gives you really easy tips. And so it's about half nutrition and health information and half original recipes.
Now, that is probably something we should all be reading right now as we head into the most fattening alcoholic part of the year. What's your advice to people as we head into the season where we have to put our bathers on but probably shouldn't be?
Yeah, well, look, the festive season is a tough time to keep all of those healthy things that you've tried to start over the year going. But I think if you just break it down into three key areas, trying to keep thinking about food and what you're doing to try and make sure that there's a bit of healthy food on your plate across the silly season. Protecting your mental health is really important across the end of the year period. And, of course, keeping active.
When you say mental health, is that the effects of drinking too much, or is that the reminders at Christmas time you might not have family that you like seeing, or what do you mean?
So if we break those three down, I think in terms of food, one really good trick is to keep the table and also your plate piled up with fruit and veg. Try and make sure that at least half the Christmas table and half your plate is fruit and veg. Another really good trick, actually, that there's good evidence for is to use smaller plates. So if you're going to have a buffet at Christmas, a really great way, particularly when it's dessert time, is to use the small dessert plates, not the huge plates. Because what we find
is that
it takes a little bit of time for our stomach and our brain to catch up with each other. Yeah. And you might still go back for seconds, but you're going back for seconds because you want it, not because your eyes were bigger than your stomach at the start.
What's the worst thing we eat or do for our health over that period, would you say?
Probably for most of us, it's the overconsumption of alcohol.
Yep.
So on that front, making sure that you have non-alcoholic options on the table, try and space things out. And particularly on hot days, Christmas can often be a really hot time of the year. Mm. Older people, but really anyone of any age, alcohol will have an extra effect on your body if you're dehydrated.
And most of us are dehydrated anyway,
aren't
we?
Most of us are, yeah. So by the time you feel thirsty, you're already dehydrated. So making sure that you're drinking plenty of water, spacing alcoholic drinks out with water, and have those healthy options. Maybe pop some fresh cut fruit in water so that it looks a bit more attractive. It also has a nice flavour to it. So those are the things I would be thinking about in terms of your food and drinks. From a mental health perspective, look, the first one is remember that it's a huge effort putting on a dinner or a lunch at Christmas or over the festive season or the new year. So just remembering that everyone in the family should and can pitch in. It's not only about making sure that it doesn't fall on one or two people, but also it's a great way of reconnecting, you know, cooking together, putting the food out together, cleaning up together. It's a great time to just check in with those around us. Of course, loneliness is a big thing at Christmas as well. The first Christmas after maybe you've lost a loved one or something has happened in your family or extended, you know, family can be really tough. So just being mindful of that with the people around you. If you know someone's on their own, invite them to be part of your Christmas. As an Italian, I have to say, we always joke that there are a few sort of extra people at Christmas and they're often the
life
of the party.
They're clambering to get there, look, can I tell you?
Well, they're welcome.
Because I'm sure the food's amazing.
It is. It is. But, you know, I think making sure that if you know someone in your neighbourhood or in your friendship circle who's going to be on their own or who's maybe going to have a tougher Christmas this year, making sure that you're not leaving them on their own. Mm. And if you find yourself on your own, you know, if you can't find a great Christmas party to join and you can't get on to me because there's an open invitation, then a great way of making sure that you're not lonely. You know, there are loads of amazing organisations out there that are doing important work on Christmas Day, whether it's serving food to, you know, vulnerable, less well-off members of our community. That's a great way of not making sure you're not on your own at a really important time of year. I think in terms of stress, that's another big thing. You know, Christmas can be quite stressful, so plan ahead, maybe get some of
really
the stuff.
Stressful. Yeah.
Yeah, particularly I think for parents. Mm. So try and think ahead. Can you get some stuff done in November?
Yep.
Stock up, get some Christmas presents done or put a few things in the cupboard. Also financially, it can be quite a stress at Christmas. So, you know, again, maybe buying a few things in November, even you know, putting things away after Christmas for the following Christmas if you can. And lastly, you know, we all know that feeling. We've just, where our bellies are full of food. It's a hot afternoon. A great thing to do after lunch is to stretch legs and get a bit of a walk together all as a group, the passeggiata, as we call it in Italian. So, you know, I think it's not, you're probably not going to get up and go to your F45 class. I certainly won't be.
Most people put their head back and fall asleep on the couch.
Yeah, but a nice thing to do is just go for a walk. Again, it's a great way of reconnecting with maybe family that you haven't seen for a while. Head down to the beach or somewhere green.
Absolutely.
Get some fresh air. That's usually where you find us is in one of the nearby parks after lunch, stretching our legs.
Now, Doctor, there is somewhere else where we find you, and that is on the television. Of all the millions of things I've said that you've achieved, you're also on Ask the Doctors.
Yeah, co-host of Ask the Doctor on ABC.
There's a funny way that came about, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I almost actually missed the opportunity.
And that's a hugely popular show.
It's been really popular. We've just finished second season and hoping to have a third next year. And it's available on Netflix worldwide now too, which is pretty funny. Sometimes I get messages from Greece or Macedonia or Peru of people who love the show, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a cold and rainy day and I was sitting at my desk at the United Nations in Geneva and this email I saw was scanning over my junk mail as like something from ABC. I was like, oh, that's rubbish. Like, it's not real. left it. A couple of weeks later, I was like, oh, I should kind of make sure that actually, in the back of my mind, something came up. And I went back and had a look in my junk mail at this email. And turns out, actually, the email was real. They were looking for someone
Here is an incredible opportunity. The clock's ticking.
Well,
you better answer.
It was a recruiting. It was the talent agency, as they call it. It's a terrible word, talent. But anyway, that's what they call us people who work in the industry, like yourself and myself as well. I emailed back and said, you know, I'd love to. But the one concern they had was that I was too serious, which kind of makes sense. I'm a total nerd. So, you know, like you look at me, I've got glasses. I'm often wearing a jacket. If I'm speaking on a topic, I can get very passionate about it. And so they were worried that I was going to be too serious for the role. The test was a Skype chat, which I totally failed. It was 7 a.m. I was sitting at my desk at the UN. I was in a tie and suit. I was trying not to speak too loudly because we had very thin walls.
So I seemed like stuffy.
Exactly what they were hoping not to have. Anyway, so on the way home, I was like, I've totally missed this opportunity. I'm going to give it one more go. And this is a great message for those who really want something, you know, like never give up. So I got my buddy. I said, Rasmus, come over to my house with your new phone. We're going to record a video and try to convince them that I'm a normal person.
Yep.
So we did this one take video of me touring my apartment, showing them the things I get excited about, talking about nutrition and urban design.
That still sounds nerdy to me.
Look, it was super nerdy, and anyone who's seen the show knows that I'm a total
but that's
nerd.
But
they could see that I also, was a bit more fun than maybe...
The things I get excited about, nutrition.
Nutrition and urban design. Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, so we sent that video off, and it was what got it over the line. The producer told me
that
6 months later, they were like, we thought you were probably too serious for the role. But then we watched that video you sent through of you kind of just freeballing in your apartment. We were like, all right, let's choose him.
That is wonderful. It's funny how those things happen. I remember my first interview for my first university degree, I turned up on the wrong day. And I'd missed the day I was supposed to turn up, but I turned up on the wrong day and I'm sitting in the hallway going, why is there no one else here? And just luckily the lecturer walked past and said, what are you doing? And then we had a laugh about it, and he was luckily a nice guy and interviewed me there and I got in. I'll never forget that.
Yep.
I could have screwed the whole thing up just because I got the day wrong.
People often ask, like, what drives you and how do you do some of the things that you do? I think, you know, to be honest, some of it is hard work, but a lot of it is also taking opportunities and being able to take opportunities, which is a huge privilege. But that one was almost went with the junk mail to the trash bin.
Oh, and then we never would have seen him on our TVs. Well, speaking of you on the TV, we thank you for being on the radio with us this evening. It has been so much fun and so informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the podcast and join me again the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Great Australian lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.